So here we go. It's the lucky draw for the first question today, and the winner is... As you mentioned yesterday, if jhanas provide the ability to change one's view about one's own existence, then how can you explain why for some serious practitioners to return to mundane life? In other words, the monks who disrobe. The reason is, and this is interesting, I don't know monks who have actually attained a real jhana if they do disrobe. It actually is one of the great teachings, again in the suttas, I love reading those original teachings of the suttas. It's the Sandaka Sutta, and there, it's actually Ananda. He said that there are four consolations of being a monk or a nun. And without those consolations, sometimes people think, what's the point of being a monk or a nun? Those four consolations, you already know what they are now. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the happiness of a monk. And it's not that, you know, all monks who stay monks have got those deep meditations. But once you get those meditations, there's not much point of doing anything else in life. Because I've already mentioned to you, even as a layperson, when I first got into a deep meditation, it was a bliss better than sex. So why do you want to disrobe when you can, you know, have this amazing experience without getting your girlfriend pregnant and getting all these other problems which, you know, you have in life when you have a family and, you know, you sort of have to live with these people. So it's great being able to get this wonderful deep happiness. Well, not only that, because it shows you what real leaving the world is. That's why when the Buddha described what jhana is like, he said there's different types of happiness. And he said, like the first jhana, he said it's like paviveka sukha. It's the bliss of renunciation. This is what happens when you do really let go. And that's what trying to be a monk or being a nun is, like you're letting go of the world. I don't just mean just, you know, letting go of family and stuff like that, because there are some people who wear the brown robes, but they haven't really renounced anything at all. They've still got their TVs, they've still got their money, they've still got everything. In fact, some of them are richer than you are. You wonder, what the heck's going on here? And still you feed them, stupid. So you've got to be careful of what you're actually doing to actually to support, you know, proper monks. Actually, somebody said that to me once in Penang. They invited these monks for the alms offering in the morning. And one of the monks, you know, there was a ding, 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 or not ding, ding, it's not ding, ding anymore, some of this music, and he got out his mobile phone. And it was one of the state-of-the-art mobile phones. And even this people who invited him for dana, even they couldn't afford a mobile phone like that. So they really thought that sort of next week the monk should invite them for dana. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So anyway, so if you really let go, and you really give up your possessions, and you live simply, and you give up all this controlling, and that's actually possessions, especially your money, that's actually your means of controlling your environment. And a little credit card, and then you can do whatever you want, whenever you want to. Like being a monk, you can't do these things, so you know, you're deliberately giving up control. You're at the mercy of other people. Even the first year we were monks, just up the road from here in our North Perth place in Magnolia Street, sometimes, in those first year, people never came to offer dana. They said they would, but they forgot. So there we were in the house, and the fridge was full of food, but we couldn't take any. Because it has to be offered to us. It has to be given to us. We can't just help ourselves. There's heaps of stuff in there. We're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And no one came. So we're completely just at the mercy of other people. But that was okay. So because of that, you renounce. And because you renounce and let go of control of your environment, which is what you do as a monk, or as a nun as well, then it's much easier to let go of control of your mind. And this is what you've been doing this weekend, letting go, letting it be. It all works out okay. So what if you don't eat for one day? You know, you can eat for the next day. You have double portions the next day, people, whatever. But the point is that when you learn how to just abandon, let go, and give up worrying about such things, then you know the way into the deep meditation. So those monks who really want to control their environment, and they want to sort of have all their possessions and their money, they don't know what deep meditation is all about. They're control freaks. And if you're a control freak, no way you can get into jhana. So it's like abandoning, letting go. That's what being a monk is. So that's why that some serious practitioners or some monks return to the worldly life, or there may be yogis who go to all these retreats and end up sort of being really, really hard-nosed business people and exploiting or whatever. It means that they missed the point. They don't know what meditation is all about. For real meditation, you just let go of the world. When you let go of the world, you float through life, and you don't need very much to be happy. What you need is a nice little place to sit down and get into deep meditation. So what more do you want in life? Yes. I better be careful there, because then some people say, I don't want to get into jhana, I'm going to leave now while the going's good. If I get into these jhanas, then I'm going to have to be a nun. I don't want to be a nun. It's just Ajahn Brahm's trick to get more nuns at Dharamsala. No, it's not the point of no return. But it will really change your life when you get into these jhanas, because you just see amazing sort of blisses and insights. You won't be able to forget it. And it'll be there for you, and you just have to keep contemplating until you figure out what the heck was that and why was that. And they do go back there more and more and more, and all these great teachings of the Buddha become so clear to you. Not through thinking, but just you've got the Dhamma right in front of you, the Dhamma of emptiness, the Dhamma of things disappearing, fading away, of cessation. That's why that later on I'll tell you that when you get into deep states of meditation, ask yourself the question, what's my earliest memory? And you get your past lives coming up. It's amazing. You can remember who you were before. It's great when you can do things like that, because after that there's no doubt at all about reincarnation. You know, it's obvious. So these are really, really important things to do. Find out for yourself. So that means it's not really the point of no return yet, but at least it really gives you a lot of insight and solidifies the Dharma of the Buddha. So that's why I teach like this, because you know, I want to sort of raise the level of understanding of, you know, the lay community here in Australia or elsewhere. No reason why you can't do these things. You used to do these things in the time of the Buddha. You know, they had two legs, two eyes, two limbs, just like you, no difference. So why can't you do these things? And one of the reasons you don't do these things is no one encourages you. And people think, oh, no, you've got to be a monk or a nun to get into these jhanas. And as for us, you know, all we can maybe do is just, you know, give money to the monks. That's wrong. So get into the jhanas, do the whole lot. And that way, you become much stronger Buddhists. You can understand exactly what's going on. That's the one thing. Sometimes when you go to interfaith meetings, sometimes what is the difference between Buddhism and all the other religions? And everyone's got their own philosophies. And you know, we can argue about if there's no self or if there's a self, exactly what the self is. Is there a God, no God, or somewhere in between? And all these other sort of theories. But what really sets Buddhism apart is it was the meditation tradition from the very beginning at the heart. It was always challenging your beliefs, actually, to see the truth in the experience of deep meditation. And the jhanas were the path. That's what meditation meant, jhana. And then seeing from that experience, not what someone tells you, but what's actually there, to re-experience what the Buddha saw. So the Dhamma is not to be disbelieved, not just to be studied, not just to be memorized, but to be experienced, each person by themselves.
And this is where you experience that. So that's why we teach like this. I know that even right now, have you ever been on pilgrimage to India? How many of people have been on pilgrimage to the four holy sites? No, you haven't. Put your hands down. If ever I ask you to put your hands up, don't do it. It's always a trick. In the Chula, honest, I keep forgetting, it was a Chula the Maha, Hathipadopama Sutta. It was the Sutta, the first teaching which the Arahat Mahinda gave when he landed in Sri Lanka. Was it the Chula? I think it was a Maha, wasn't it? Or the Chula? Chula one. The Chula Hathipadopama Sutta. But in that sutta, it says, like, and this person was searching for a big elephant. They saw all these signs, but they couldn't know whether it was a big elephant or not until they actually saw it sitting there. And the Buddha said, that's the first footprint of the elephant. And he said, the first footprint of the Buddha, the Tathagata, is first jhana. The second footprint is second jhana. The third footprint is third jhana. The fourth footprint is the fourth jhana. They are the footprints of the Buddha. So any of you who go up to Suripada, Adam's Peak, that's not the footprint of the Buddha. If you go to Thailand, and there's a place there, Prabhutabhat, that's not the footprint of the Buddha. If you go to Bodh Gaya, there's a stone there, that's not the footprint of the Buddha. The footprints of the Buddha are right inside you right now. And those are the four holy places where the Buddha hung out. And you don't have to get a visa or go on any aircraft to go there. You just need just to go deep inside and to hang out where the Buddha hang out. And when you get into one of those jhanas, you've got like the mind of a Buddha. That's how the Buddha experienced many, many days. And there's no difference in that experience between your mind and the mind of a Buddha. And that's really amazing. When you come out afterwards, then you're an ordinary person again. But when you're in those states, you're free of defilements. That's amazing. So those of you who want to go on pilgrimage, you've come to the right place. And you don't have to go along all these bumpy roads and eat all this food where you get diarrhea. This is Ajahn Brahm's pilgrimage to the holy sites. So, is that okay? Any questions about that? Okay, the next question. In meditation, we are attempting to let go of defilements, greed, etc., and hindrances, etc. Does this mean that human beings, by their nature, have these, and that is the reason for attempting to lose them? Once lost, does this alter the nature of human beings, defilements, etc.? Maybe I don't need to worry about this just now. Yes, you do. Those of you who have defilements, you're getting into big trouble because of those defilements, especially greed. Not only is it destroying your bank balance, not only is the credit card company after you, but also you are burning up the world with global warming. Because all of the things which you consume because of your greed, and do you really need those things? How much stuff have you got in your cupboard? And how much do you really need? How much stuff did you bring here for this retreat? And how much do you really need? That's greed and delusion as well. So, you have got those defilements there. And why do you have these defilements? You know, you think that, oh, if I take this extra stuff on there, I'll be happy. If I get angry, I'm going to tell that person what they really need to know. I needed to tell them, although rather they needed to know. And it's passing the bucket. They didn't need to know that at all. They didn't need to hear it at all. In fact, that would be much better if you never got angry at them. Nevertheless, you think you need to. The point is there that these defilements create lots of problems in this world and lots of trouble for you. Why get angry? It's a stupid thing to do. Because why, what other people say or do, why do you allow that to control your happiness? They can call you a pig,
They can call you the backside of an elephant, like I saw on somebody's t-shirt today. It's not very pretty. It must be one of those punk t-shirts, Sri Lankan style. The back of an elephant. But anyway, the backside of an elephant, not all that pretty, but if someone calls you a backside of an elephant, so what? You know, once in Singapore, they're advertising my talks, and they put the advert on the back of a bus. So people started joking. Ajahn Brahm, he looked like the back of a bus, because it was true. I was on the back of a bus. And the point being there is that you don't get angry or upset what other people do to you or say to you. There's no need to allow other people's actions of body or speech to make you angry. It's a wonderful realization that you have complete freedom to get angry or not, but not because people make you. Isn't it wonderful that you're beyond another person's control? They can't do anything with you. They can't make you angry. They can shout at you. They can give you the two finger sign or one finger sign. You don't get angry at all. So, anger is called ill will. It means your will is sick. That's why it's called ill will. So don't be sick, be healthy. So have healthy will, not ill will. So it's good to actually, and this is meditation, you let go of these defilements temporarily by being peaceful, being still. And you've realized just how wonderful it is just to not to carry the burden of other people, of the world, of even your body. You let go completely of all your defilements. You go to this beautiful, pure mind. That's why we call them defilements, because once they're gone, your mind is so pure and beautiful and nice and brilliant. And it's nice to hang out with a pure mind. And once you get the taste of freedom from defilements, wow, you want that again and again. That's a 5-star meal on offering, the taste of freedom. Not the taste of curry or the taste of what do we have today? We had a shepherd's pie today. Not the taste of shepherd's pie, but the taste of jhanas, the taste of freedom, is on the menu at this retreat. So, take that off the buffet offered to you here. So that when we actually lose these defilements, we feel so much better. We feel more peaceful, free, happy. And once we can do that, we understand how wonderful it is, and we start to lessen our defilements little by little. We wear them out. There's no point to them anymore. What are you greedy for? Whenever you're greedy, whenever you want something, it's called suffering. The reason is because you are separated from what you want. If you want something, it means you haven't got it yet. So there's some business to do. There's some craving. You're separated from what you want as soon as you have a want. And you either get it, and as soon as you get what you want something more, it never satisfies you. All desire is, what's the word? All desire is unfaithful to you. It promises you, as soon as you get me, then you'll be happy. That's why sometimes you're reading the newspapers that people say, all I want is that you to get my visa to come to Australia. It's not all they want. As soon as they get that, they want something more. Anyone who says, all I want is, you know, just to get rid of my cancer. Of course it's not. If you get rid of the cancer, you're not going to be enlightened. You want something more. So the point is that our wanting is never ending. And that's why we never have any peace. So there are two freedoms to be found in the world. The freedom of desire, which means you can desire whatever you want. And the freedom from desire. We have no more desires, no more defilements. We're perfectly happy. Don't want anything. And the old story which I've told was when I was a young monk. I'm very old now. As soon as I say this, many of the monks sitting next to me think, here he goes again. Just comparing the good old days with today's sloppy, scallywag monk community. But no, they're very, very good monks here. But when I was a young monk, again, we were very, very strict. You know, we kept a huge amount of simplicity. But even then, even as a young monk, you'd help people now and again. Someone wanted to have a problem solved. If you could, you'd try and help them. And one day I'd help one lay person who came to the monastery, this Thai man. And so he was so grateful, he said, look, now, I'm going to give a donation to the monastery, but I want something for you. Do you need anything personal? And usually what you do, you can't accept money as a monk, but what you can do, they can say, well, you know, it's 100 baht, which was, about $3. But no, this was 30 years ago. He said, I've got 100 baht here, sort of, for you. Tell me what you want for the price of 100 baht. They would usually say the amount. This for you personally, not for the monastery. Now, what do you need? And I was actually quite stunned because I never actually thought I needed anything. But I started thinking, and he was in a hurry like most people are. So he said, look, I'm coming back tomorrow. You think about it and tell me tomorrow. So I said, okay, that's a good idea. So he went away and I went back to my hut. And I got out a piece of paper like this. So I said, what do I want? And actually, I needed some aerograms. So I could actually write back to my family. So I wrote down aerograms. Actually, I needed a pen to write those aerograms. So I wrote down the pen. And actually, I needed some pencils as well. And then I found out I needed some little cassette tape so I can record some of Asian Charles talks. And I found I needed something else. I needed sort of a new towel. Actually, I needed also a razor. I needed. And after about 2 minutes, I'd had such a list there. There was much more than 100 baht, and I had to sort of scratch off something, but I couldn't because they were all really necessary. And when I was trying to scratch off something, I thought of some more things I wanted. And in 10 minutes, I had 1,000 baht's worth of stuff. If I'd have gone on like that another hour, I'd have had 1,000,000 baht. And everything which is on that list now was absolutely necessary. I don't know how I ever lived without it before. And as soon as I saw what was going on, you can recognize it, I tore up the piece of paper and threw it away. And when that guy came the following day, I said, don't ever do that to me again. I don't care what you do with that 100 baht, but don't give it to me. Before, I was so happy, you know, in my poverty. And now you've made me just have all these desires come up. You rotter. And that's what happens. So when you haven't got any ability to get anything, you know, you want for nothing. And it's a beautiful saying, to want for nothing. Usually you apply that to very wealthy people, you know, the billionaires, they want for nothing, they've got so much money. Well, actually the billionaires, well, they still work very hard, they still want things. But as for a monk, you've got no money anyway, so waste of time, you don't even think about it. So literally, you do want for nothing. And that's so much freedom. So understand how desire works. Whether it's 100 baht, 1,000 baht, $1,000,000, or $2,000,000. If I knew the lottery numbers this week, would you want them? Oh, come on! I want them for nothing! It won't make you happy, I promise. But you say, but I want to find out for myself. When, if ever, do you recommend consciously scanning the body for sensations in meditation? Okay, you don't really need to scan the body for sensations. There's always some sensations there. It's always painful. There's nothing in the body which is very, very peaceful. Now, you'd actually just even look at all the other people in this room now. You know, someone's pulling their ear. Someone is just, again, just scratching their nose. Another person... Because you can't sit still, can you? Why can't you sit still? The reason is because the body is irritating. There's always something which needs to be done. I often say that's why in this type of meditation, out of compassion, everyone meditates with their eyes closed. You know why we do that? So that when everyone's eyes closed, that's when you can pick your nose or put your finger in the ear and no one can see it. So you can actually adjust your body by scratching places you wouldn't dare scratch in public because everyone's got their eyes closed. Unfortunately, in not a moment, they've got a camera now. So I can't do that anymore. But the point is that, you know, your body is always irritating. There's always some feelings and sensations there, which I'll just scratch my nose because it's irritating me. So the best thing to do is just actually leave your body alone. To actually abandon the body. To put it in a posture where it's reasonably comfortable and just focus on present moment awareness, silence and the breath as soon as you can so the whole body disappears.
And that's the only time you're really comfortable. So really what you should be doing is not scanning the body, but dropping the body, letting go of your attachment to the body. So you can just leave it aside and focus on the mind. Because the feelings in the body, I don't think that they're... Oh, there's always something going on. Sure, you can experience pain and you can sort of see pain as just a sensation and happiness is a sensation, but it doesn't make you enlightened. But if you see all the sensations in the body going, that makes you enlightened. So I'd actually say no need to scan the body. Maybe you can scan at the beginning just to make it comfortable. But then let go of the body as soon as you can. Transcend it. Dear Ajahn, where does the breath stop? The breath stops here. That's where it stops, here. It seems to be intimately connected with all psychophysical phenomena in the body. Physical phenomena, yeah, but not so much psychic phenomena, because the body can actually completely, the breath can completely stop. And even to be continuous with the rest of all, living things, or should we limit awareness to a particular aspect of the breath? Please exhale some wisdom. Okay. Now, when you get into the deep meditations, even though you're not aware of the breath is still going in and going out. But if you really go deep, then the breath actually stops. And so that's usually fourth jhana. It says in the books fourth jhana, but that's actually what happens. The breath stops. And you all may know one of the weird stories which I like telling people. When Ajahn Chah was in his last years of his life, he was very sick, could not speak, he had a stroke, you know, some excess fluid on the brain. But even though he was not able to speak, he was still meditating. And the reason we knew this was as follows, that he would have constant care by a nurse paid for by the King of Thailand, 8-hour shift throughout the day. And it was also like monks would also help. On this occasion, a few monks were looking after Ajahn Chah in the middle of the night when Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And as soon as he stopped breathing, the nurse on duty there started to panic. Ajahn Chah's dying. And as I usually say, everyone knew that Ajahn Chah would die one day, but that nurse did not want this famous monk to die on his shift. And that was the problem there, he was afraid. And the monk said, no, he does this very regularly, leave him alone. And he said, no, he's not breathing, he'll die. I mean, he doesn't die, he's just going into the deep meditations. The very fact he could do this was very strong, convincing evidence that Ajahn Chah was meditating, because that's the only time this can happen. And they came to this decision to let Ajahn Chah alone, but the doctor, or the nurse rather, on duty, actually took blood samples every few minutes. Because the argument was, as long as the blood is well oxygenated, then there's no brain damage due to lack of oxygen. That's what happened. So they kept testing his blood every few minutes while he wasn't breathing at all. I mean, a couple of hours, I think it was. I'm not quite sure exactly how long it was, but quite a few hours. And at all that time, the blood was perfectly well oxygenated. Which meant that the doctor would leave him alone. Or the nurse would leave him alone. And then he came out of his meditation and started breathing again. That was actually, medically, impossible, I would say. But that's what happened. That was a sign he was just getting into jhana. So that when you do stop breathing, you're in a very deep state of meditation. So that's what happens. So that's where the breath really, really stops, in the fourth jhana. You don't need to breathe anymore. But you're not dead. You're just suspended. And you come out afterwards and start breathing again. No problem at all. So there we go. Any questions about that? Dr. Batten, does that make any sense?
Yes, and of course if the metabolism is zero,
yeah,
the oxygen will remain the same level, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. But there's still the blood is getting pumped around the body, so there must be some sort of some work being done and the temperature's being maintained.
It has to drop some level.
Yeah, but there was no breath discerned at all. So it's very interesting. What's going on? Who knows? Yes, do you know?
I was just wondering if But you've said earlier that it's impossible to harm a monk who's in a jhana.
Yes.
How do they take his life?
In other words, harming is actually injuring them, or bruising them, or whatever. But yeah, it's always sort of take blood from the person. It's not as if their skin is just so hard, like sort of Superman, and you just can't sort of penetrate it. But no, it's just I think by harming, I mean this. I told a story; they can't be burned, and they and there's one monk, this Indonesian monk who I knew. Before he was a monk, he got into a very deep meditation in the jungle of Java, and he was there for a few days in deep meditation. And during that time, there was a flood which had covered him. He hadn't known anything about it. So he was underwater for hours and hours and hours and hours in his meditation, but didn't know anything about it. He was just in deep meditation. He came out afterwards, he noticed the marks on the trees, he asked the villagers if he'd been in a deep flood. So, those are weird stories. What happens? Anyway, thank you, Ajahn. I followed your instructions when you gave the talk on mindfulness, and for the first time, the crazy mind became calm, and I found the breath, or the breath found me. Ah, this is one of those happy endings to a romance story. First of all, I saw the breath at a distance, and it looked so beautiful, but then it disappeared from me. It was taken by someone else. But I fell in love with the breath at first sight, but then we were separated for such a long time, and I was heartbroken, but then we met, and then we fell in love and got married, and we lived happily ever after. Isn't it romantic? They found the breath at last, the breath found you. Sorry. I found... Using present moment and silent present moment when doing walking meditation also helped a lot. The mind has become more peaceful, thank you, yeah. So I don't mean to sort of belittle that, but, you know, it's wonderful. It actually does work. That's why I give these instructions. But you have to follow the instructions. It's like what most people do, though. They get some new gizmo from Harvey Norman's or whatever else shop you go to. And what do most people do? They plug it in and try it out, first of all. And when it goes bang, only then do they look at the instructions. So it makes much more sense to look at the instructions first of all, to read them, and don't rush to start plugging things in and pushing all the buttons and see what happens. So if you read the instructions first and follow them, it usually works. That's why they're called instructions. So, not obstructions. Instructions. So you actually go and find those instructions, follow them, and this is what happens. And I like the way the person says, the crazy mind became calm, and the breath found you. So when you're really peaceful and calm, you're putting the conditions into place, and the breath comes in. Sometimes I gave a simile years ago. It's like having a room in a house. But you set up all the room there, like a lunch, and you know, make some really nice food, you make it nice and pretty and tidy and attractive, and once all the lunch is set up there, you open the door, people are going to come in, because it's a nice place to come to. So you have to make your mind attractive for the breath. You don't go out there and see the breath and drag it in, come in, you have to come in, because that's called rape. It's violence. So you can't, you know, do abuse of your breath, come in here or else. So instead you make it nice and pretty and beautiful and nice, have a nice, calm, peaceful, happy mind, and the breath comes in, it likes to visit you. And that's how you find present moment awareness and silence. And doing walking meditation is very useful as well. Because sometimes you're sitting a long time, you ache, and also you've got your eyes closed so you fall asleep. So when you're walking, your eyes are open, you're doing some exercise, you're doing something. So that's much easier to focus and get in the present moment awareness and silence. Very good question. Next question. What can I do to stop hearing the birds singing as soon as I get a nimitta? Shoot them. With letting go, not with arrows. This happens within a few seconds almost. Okay, you know the answer. It's not the birds disturb you. you disturb the birds. And they're just birds doing bird things, that's all. So your job is not to really be so concerned about it. If a nimitta comes up and you hear the bird singing or the person next to you doing something or other, don't put that disturbance in the centre of your screen. You can have the nimitta there, or if you're watching the breath or whatever else you're watching, but have those sounds of the birds on the edge, in the background. If it's a problem, then the problem comes to the centre of your screen. It's the main thing in your mind, and that's when the nimitta or the breath falls off the edge of the screen. If you watch the TV screen, so the picture on the top and the magazines underneath disappear. But if you watch the picture on top of the screen, the TV screen disappears. So whatever you're focusing on will eventually remain. So if you have a disturbance like that, or a feeling in the body which is giving a lot of pain, don't focus on it. Don't try and get rid of it, but have a middle way where it's on the edge of your awareness, but you're keeping the focus in the middle, on your breath or on the nimitta. And that way, after a while, just the disturbance will disappear. The birds will just vanish, because you're not disturbing them. You're allowing them to be, but you're not focusing on them. That makes sense, because it's a great question. Because any disturbance in meditation, sometimes we make that disturbance the most important thing, which means it centers, and we lose our meditation object. So you can still have a disturbance, but it's on the edge, it's out here somewhere. We're still focusing on the central thing. Yeah? It can also disappear, but sometimes everything else disappears as well. Your meditation disappears, and the birds disappear, and you start thinking about something else. So it's much better actually to not focus on the disturbance. Because you know, sometimes people focus on the disturbance and they start having all these strategies of what they're going to do to those birds. Maybe next time you've been poisoned, or whatever. It's amazing what strategies, even though you keep the precepts. If I could read your mind, and some of the thoughts which you have are just really weird and strange, and they're really sort of way over and beyond keeping the precepts.
Yeah. And the difference will be that because you feel the bird as interrupt you, you know, like you
call
it that evil. But for example, if you listen to chanting, and you concentrate on that, and then with a high concentration, you can have absolutely peace. But maybe because when you started, you don't have an ill will, you have faith. Is that correct?
That's right, but I think a number of people have ill will when we start the chanting, especially in the morning. It doesn't matter. That's why the morning chanting is to wake up the dead. And you know who those dead are. But no, it's just, and what usually happens is, if you want to, in the beginning of the meditation, it's fine. Just listen to the birds, because it can center you in the present moment, because it is actually delightful, the sound of the birds and the over here. But after a while, if you want to go deeper, especially if you have a nimitta, then you don't really want to focus on the sound of the birds. It's too much out there, not enough in here. So if you're at the nimitta stage, then you just want to keep the sound of the birds on the edge of the screen so it falls off pretty quickly. Okay, next question. Can you please explain how we can overcome fear? Fear is part of the practice of meditation. Every time you come across fear, I mean sort of the deep fears of meditation, well done. Because every time you come across fear, it's the beginning of an insight happening. The fear is noticing an attachment about to be taken away from you. All fear is about losing something which you take to be precious. And so, when things start to disappear, this is when fear comes up. And when that comes up, you know, great, you're on the edge of an insight here. So just hang out there, stay there.
until you decide or discover what you're really afraid of losing. And they think, why am I afraid of losing this? It doesn't really, I don't really own it. It's not mine, and actually it's a big burden. So you allow it to go, and you feel so much freedom afterwards. And once you see that process occur again and again and again, in the deep meditation you get a fear, but you stay there, and you see what's about to disappear, and you see it disappear, and you see that after fear comes the losing of something, and after losing it comes freedom. Then you always look at fear as a different light. Fear is just like the beginning of freedom. So it's a different light, you're seeing it. And don't be think that fear is an obstacle. Because you are in good company, as I said to someone today. In a Mahasatchika Sutta, the Buddha, when he recalled the time as a young boy under the rose apple tree, he got into the first jhana. And he'd never done that again since. He was about to sit under the Bodhi tree and become a Buddha. And he said, why am I so afraid of that pleasure and that power of first jhana? So even the Buddha was afraid. And then he said, I will not be afraid. And from that time on, he kept on saying, of the first, second, third, fourth jhana, not by yitabhang, by waitabhang, ase witabhang, bahuri katabhang. The first one is, you should not be afraid of it. Now, bayita bang, those of you who come from Malaysia, baya is like danger. It's not to be afraid of, it's not dangerous. And bayita bang should be developed, asewita bang should be followed, and bahuri kata bang should be made much of. Do as much as you like. So fear can come up at first, but it also came up for the Buddha. So you know you're in good company. And it's always fear of losing something. And in a deep meditation, the fear which is coming up of losing the controller, losing control, losing your body, losing your identity, losing your all your possessions, what define you. But I guarantee it's going to be so freeing. As I mentioned to someone today who was doing walking meditation, one great way of doing walking meditation I haven't mentioned yet is using a mantra. As you do the left step, you say, I will die. As you do your right step, you continue with, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And you keep on doing that for, you know, half an hour, and eventually it gets through to your thick skull. This is actually what you're saying is absolutely true. It's not just a joke, it's actually real words. And it's a real truth. And then you know you've done it correctly because fear comes up. The fear of actually dying. And once you get to that fear, it's afraid of letting go of your body, which, you know, you find you are attached to after all. But you stay with that fear. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And usually what happens next, you've seen what you're afraid of, losing this body, you understand it doesn't belong to you anyway, and you go through that fear. And you carry on walking, you get so peaceful. Because when you know I will die, that's for sure, it means all your possessions and attachments, the sorts of stuff which you think about, become completely meaningless. Your family, your home, you know, all the concern with your money, your status, even the health or lack of health of your body. You're going to die anyway, so we're all the same. Doesn't matter, you maybe have a cancer, I may not have a cancer, someone else may have something else. When we all die, it's all the same. So you feel totally free after you've been through that fear of I will die, that's for sure. It's great afterwards. You've actually confronted that fear and gone through it. So it's good to actually to see that fear is always losing something of yours. When you realize you don't own it anyway, you're not afraid anymore. Are you afraid of this building here burning down? especially next week after you've left? Of course not, because it doesn't belong to us. But are you afraid of your house burning down? You're afraid of that, because that belongs to you. So remember what fear is. It's always something of yours being taken away. So that's why the insight is usually preceded by a fear. And afterwards, it comes freedom. Does that make sense? Okay, any questions about that? The next question. In my meditation, I notice different effects when reciting a word, e.g. Buddho, or I'm going to die, that's for sure. Aha! See, that must have been premonition. They've written it down here. Some words seem to help to concentrate the mind and some keep the mind alert. Could you please talk about this effects? Yeah, I've already mentioned it a little bit. It depends, whatever word it is, if it has a meaning to you, all these mantras, and if you go to TM, you have to pay thousands of dollars to get a mantra, and it's top secret. But you know my favourite mantra, which I found very effective for Westerners? It's not I will die, that's for sure. It's not Buddho, Buddho. My favourite mantra, as you breathe in, you chant to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up, shut, up, shut, up, shut, up. So you stop thinking for a change. That's a very secret mantra. So you're not allowed to tell it to anybody else. Of course you are. But that's whatever actually works for you. And if you've got a playful mind, some of those mantras you make up for yourself are very useful. So, but you have to find out which one works for you. I found Buddha also seems to let lots of insights to flow into the mind. Very profound, mind-blowing truths. Amazing. This happened without being in a jhana, but maybe at a samadhi level. Didn't Buddha say there are two ways to realize these truths, jhanas and wisdom? Could this be the way? Could you please explain this? With my practical experience, I can't agree with you that jhana has to happen to realize these truths about dukkha and anatta. Ah, what you've realized so far is not the full picture. That's why you can't claim to be enlightened, why you still get angry, why you still have attachments. So be careful here. Some of the wisdoms which you do get are still not the real thing. They're not full. They're still superficial. You've seen some suffering, but not the whole picture. There's still something you're clinging on to. That's why you do need the jhanas. And the Buddha said that. He said, without the jhanas, you cannot get enlightened. That's in the 64th sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Malunkyaputta Sutta. No more, he said, than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and the sapwood. And it's not two ways, jhanas and wisdom. His jhana creates the wisdom. There's not two ways to enlightenment. That's the furphy. Furphy is just a false teaching. As the Buddha said, samadhi pachaya yata buddhi yana dasanam. It's from those jhanas you see things as they truly are. And without the jhanas, the cause is destroyed for seeing things as they truly are. If you don't believe me, you can ask me to show you those suttas and I'll show you them word for word. So, this is the way to get fully enlightened, properly enlightened. Any questions about that one? Da, da, da. Okay, next question. Many people from the ancient areas wear a thread around the wrist. Please, Ajahn, is this something recommended by the Buddha? All the cricketers wear heaps of thread but still lose the game. Why? Ah, because the thread doesn't come from Ajahn Brahm, that's why. No, sometimes you have these traditions of holy threads, and sometimes to keep people quiet you give them away. Because it's much easier just to give a piece of thread to a person and explain how stupid they are. Because people don't accept that. But I remember one day, this Thai lady, I was giving out these holy threads people wear around their wrists, and this Thai lady asked for a big one, a long one. So what do you want a big one for? Oh, it's for my husband's neck. I said, no, you're not going to do that with my holy thread. Strangle the guy. That's what she wants.
But no, sometimes they have these little talismans and threads and stuff like that. But it's like someone said that sometimes it's very good actually to stop this these superstitious parts of Buddhism. Because well, people all do that, and it's true if everyone gets them. I mean, they say this because one of the stories I do with holy threads. Some years ago, the Sri Lankan cricket team were playing Australia in a one-day match at the Wacker, the big cricket ground, just a couple of kilometres from here. And at half-time, at lunch break, the Australians were just really beating the Sri Lankans terribly badly. And so there was a couple of Sri Lankan boys, actually Talitha's sons. They were doing some cultural show during the lunch break. And so one of the cricketers, the Sri Lankan cricket team, just asked them, can you get some holy thread? We're desperate. And so I was the only monk in town, so they came up, quickly to me in Nolamara Temple. Can we have some holy thread for the Sri Lankan cricket team? They're losing. So I quickly blessed some thread and cut 12 pieces, because I know cricket, I used to play cricket, at least watch it anyway. So, 11 men and the 12th man, I gave one to him as well, because sometimes he comes on. At least he comes on with a drinks tray. But anyway, so I did 12 pieces of thread, and I sent them off. I never thought about it, but I did see in the following day's newspaper the Sri Lankan team lost. But that's not the end of the story. Just because that was just a warm-up for the World Cup cricket match, or contest, which was in India and Pakistan. And many of you know that the final was between Australia and Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka won. They won the World, the Australians, you know how much they love their cricket. And they were just so disappointed. The Australia got to the final, but they got beaten by Sri Lanka. And the Sri Lankans were just over the moon. There was parties all over the place in Sri Lanka. And the following morning, it was on the front page of the local paper here, the West Australian. They had the captain, Arjuna Ranatunga, who was holding up the World Cup, which Australia had lost. And because he was holding up, it was only then I noticed on this picture on the front page, Arjuna Ranatunga had a string on, and I recognised that string. That was my string. That was the reason Australia lost, because I gave string. And if I'd have told people at that time, I don't mind telling them now, but if I'd have told the reason why Australia got beaten was because an Australian monk gave the enemy some string, I'd have been kicked out of Australia. I'd have been put in the equivalent of Guantanamo Bay. You know, see what happened to Sheikh Al-Hilali, that would be nothing compared to what they did to me. But that was my string story. But anyhow, that string. And there's a lot of superstition, but people believe in that. And sometimes it's the power of belief. And so sometimes we can use that if a person's really desperate and they need something to cling on to. We use that as a means so that they can be encouraged. Well, again, it's true there's too much of that in Buddhism, and sometimes, at least I give it away for free, but other people actually charge you for this. And that's really gross that people charge you for these things. Same with holy water. We sprinkle holy water over people. It's a nice part of a blessing, and it has a point to it. I always sprinkle holy water at a marriage ceremony. Because they have marriage, they say, well, it's spiritual, and I have to give it meaning and truth. So I always sprinkle holy water, and most of it goes on the bride. Because I want the groom to find out what his partner is really looking like when all the makeup starts dripping off. I said that one Friday night, and I got all these emails from women in the United States, and they said, we're never going to listen to you anymore, you're a misogynist. That's what I got, emails. But anyhow, so that's why we do the holy water. But it's just that the holy water's got something to it, because you see this work done by, what is his name? This Japanese guy. The organization is called Heido. It's Professor Inamoto or something? I haven't checked it out properly, but he's got all these photographs of what happens when you bless water and it changes its crystalline structure. So there seems to be something there with a bit of chanting and a bit of holy water. So there may be something there, but you've got to be very careful not to overdo that. And the last story, because even just the last couple of weeks, apparently there have been lots of students going to Serpentine Monastery. You know why? It's exam time. And some students get a bit worried about their exams, especially after they've done their paper. And they say, oh my goodness, I better do something, quick. So they go to the monastery, give a bit of dana, and hopefully add to their good karma to increase their grades. And that happened some years ago. My predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, this woman came, she was studying at UWA, and asked for some chanting, because she'd just done her exams. Actually, just before she was doing her exams, she did the chanting. And then we never saw her again. She never gave a donation or anything. And we wondered where she'd gone. And then we found out from her friends that she'd failed. And she was going around blaming us monks. The monks at Nolamara Temple are hopeless. They don't know how to chant. And her argument for that was because she failed. She expected us, you know, to turn her failed mark into a pass mark. Of course you can't do that. Now what the Buddha actually said, and it's a great teaching, which I think a lot of monks aren't game enough to reveal to people. It's in the suttas, when he said, imagine, monks, that there was a jar, like a clay jar of oil, and we broke it over some water and dropped it in that water. The clay would all fall to the bottom, and the oil would float to the top of that water. Now imagine a monk came and did some chanting. Do you think through chanting he could make that clay rise to the surface and the oil fall to the bottom? No, said the monks. Correct, said the Buddha. It's the nature of oil to float to the top and the clay to go to the bottom. In the same way, he said, that when monks chant when somebody dies, you know, if they're going to go down, they're going to go down. If they're going to go up, they're going to go up. And all the chanting is a bit of a waste of time. And that's from the word of the Buddha. Isn't that amazing? That all the chanting which people, they pay monks and nuns, all this money, in other traditions, not us, we don't get paid. All this money to chant at your funeral, because they want, you know, the monks to make sure that you don't go up to heaven. And they know you'd be the scallywag, you don't deserve to go up there. And that's why, you know, they really get desperate and they get the best monks and it don't matter how much they charge. Because, you know, it's like a bribery to get you up to heaven. It can't work that way. If you're a scallywag and you've been misbehaving, all the charting in the world won't make oil fall down to the bottom or clay rise to the surface. Will it? Yes.
Yes. During the time of the Buddha, when the town of Vedari was have been what is called famine,
famine.
And then put it in brief like one of the noble people said to invite the Buddha. And then apart from like make the town start with all the disease gone, the Buddha also made a holy water for Venerable Ananda to go and sprinkle to all the sick people and things like that. And is that the true story?
We're not sure because that's in the commentaries. It's not in the original suttas. So the commentaries were written a long time afterwards. Remember, I read it, he was just doing the Ratana Sutta, just but chanting it, circling around the city. No holy water at all. So that's actually how I remember it. But I also remember that we were in a drought in Thailand and all the villages, you know, they couldn't plant their rice. So we decided to do some chanting to get some water, to get some rain. And this was actually when Ajahn Sumedho was the abbot of Wat Nanachat. And so we all met in the hall, and we did this, so we found this old chant to make rain. We did this chant, and the only thing we got, one of the old monks had to go outside to go to the toilet. That's all the water we got. So if it was that easy, then you know, all the monks, there wouldn't be any droughts in Australia, or any floods in Thailand. But that's, you know, sometimes what happens. You know, you've got to be very careful with monks, because there's such a thing called priestcraft, and what happens, you know, is that
if it's a drought like we have over here, and say, well, you know, if it wasn't have the monks here doing the chanting, it would be even worse than it is now. So you never actually know exactly what's going on. The point is, it all goes according to nature, cause and effect. And the job of Buddhism is not to control nature, but learning how to be at peace with nature. And it's, instead of actually waiting till you die and then get the monks to do some chanting, it's much better to listen to the teachings while you're still alive. It's much more powerful. So the whole purpose of those teachings there was actually to understand some of the Dhamma. Now, in the Thai tradition, at a person's funeral in Thailand, they chant the Abhidhamma in Pali. Now, number one, sort of the person who dies can't understand Pali. And number two, the Abhidhamma is so abstruse, they'll never understand, even if it would chant it in Thai, they wouldn't understand what it was. But they keep on doing that. Now, what's the point of that? Some of the traditions, we need to keep questioning them. Challenging them, otherwise Buddhism will die. Just another priestcraft. And people will rightly challenge. Okay, next question. The starting time of a talk was changed, so I arrived halfway through, taught by a visiting teacher from another tradition. He said, if you concentrate on the feet too much, you get depressed. Something along these lines. I'm not sure how it related to what he'd been talking about. Is this so? Well, I've been concentrating on my feet for years. I'm not depressed. No, I can't. He must have misunderstood what he said. I've never heard that one before. Concentrate on the feet, you get depressed. No, I can't see that. Also, I read in a book by a meditation teacher that too much yoga nidra or body scanning inside will cause depression. Is this so? Of course it's not. If you do any type of meditation, it just makes you really happy. The only point where you get depression if you do like the loathsome meditations. And sometimes people do that. You deliberately don't look upon the beautiful, look on the ugly part of your body. And think of what's going inside of you right now. All the shit and the pus and all the terrible stuff which is oozing out of every orifices right now. And some monks get into that. And according to the times of the Buddha taught monks this, looking at the loathsome part of the body in order that they would lessen their lust. That's actually what we teach young novice monks and novice nuns. When they first ordain, we tell them the five meditations on hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin. If you go to an ordination of a novice now, at our monastery, we have to keep doing this, it's tradition. And the reason we do this is like, imagine like a young novice, they're coming into the monastery for the first time, but they still, they've got their lust, and they still sort of see a pretty girl, and they sort of get, hot. And in order to try and balance that, I mean, this one of our young monks, a poor fellow, one of our Katina ceremonies a couple of years ago, there's so many people at the monastery that these couple of, they call them these days hot chicks, so just passing by, they weren't coming to the monastery, they saw all these cars outside and thought something's going on, so they decided to come into the monastery and check it out. And they were dressed like they're going to a nightclub. Not coming, this is Sunday afternoon, perhaps they just come out of a nightclub, more than likely. And there's poor one of our youngest monks there, they made a beeline for him straight away. And this poor young monk, he'd only just become a monk, after they left, he had to lay down for a couple of hours. Poor fellow. So in order to actually help out, sort of stop lust, we have the five recollections. Hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin. Because that's what you see. If you look at me now, what can you see? All you can see is hair of the head, hair of the body, maybe you can see my stubble, nails, teeth and skin. That's what's on the external part of a person's body. And there's a doctor here, there's many other people who know anatomy. The hair which you see is all dead. Because the roots are actually underneath. So when you look at a person's hair, it's all dead stuff. Same as if there's a moustache or a beard, it's all dead. Same with the nails, that's all dead stuff. The roots are hidden. Teeth the same, roots are inside. And the skin, the surface of the skin is dead, it's flaking off.
because the live part is a millimeter or two under the surface. So you say when you have this reflection, hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin, it means what you're seeing you recognize as all dead stuff. So if you see that hot chick coming in and you want to sort of kiss her, what you're kissing is dead stuff. If you want to stroke her beautiful hair, it's all dead stuff. So when you think about it like that, your lust goes pretty quickly. So that's why they have these super meditations. But sometimes, in this particular case, the monks got into it too much and they got really depressed, negative, they started committing suicide. And the Buddha actually said afterwards, he said, that's taking it too far. You get into too much negativity. And it's only there to balance lust. So you actually get a balance there. Because when you get lust, you're looking at the most attractive part of that person. And you're in denial to every other part of them. And that's what actually happens. So, it's to balance it. But if you go that too far, that can make you depressed. And that's why afterwards, when the Buddha sort of saw that happening, he said, do anapanasati, it's much better. So, yeah, the walking meditation and scanning doesn't make you depressed. It makes you wise. It makes you peaceful. Next question. Cannot one get into jhanas by doing vipassana alone? Haha, there's no such thing as vipassana alone. There's no such thing as jhana alone. The two go together. Once upon a time, Mr. Samatha decided to go on a walk with Mrs. Vipassana, his best friend. They decided to go up a mountain, up a hill. Mr. Samatha wanted to go up there because it was so peaceful and cool on top of the mountain. Mrs. Vipassana wanted to go up there because it had a gorgeous view. They went up there together, and when they got to the top, Mr. Samatha, he enjoyed the peace. It was so calm up there. But he had a pair of eyes, so he also saw the gorgeous view. As for Mrs. Vipassana, his partner, oh, she enjoyed the amazing view. But she also experienced a wonderful calm. Because on top of the mountain, calm and insight, the view, live together. So you may be going up there for the calm, but you will see the view. You may be going up there for the view, but you will experience the calm. They always go together. Now that is my simile, but Ajahn Chah constantly, repeatedly said there is no difference between real vipassana, real samatha. They are the same. You have to be peaceful. Then you see things. The sign of you seeing things is you become peaceful. That's what these things are. So they always go together. One may be in front, but the other one is right behind. They are inseparable. Any questions about that? It's causing a lot of trouble for people in this world when people say, oh, you can just do vipassana alone, don't do samatha, it's bad for you. Other people say, oh, just do samatha, vipassana is bad for you. They're all the same thing. It's eightfold path. And read the suttas. The Buddha never said, just do samatha, just do vipassana. He said, just do jhanas, just do eightfold path. Always trust what the Buddha said. Don't trust what monks say. Or nuns say. Read it for yourself. And you check it out and it's right there. Very clear. I believe that there are Hindu gurus who meditate and attain various stages of jhana. Buddha before enlightenment did attain various jhanas. Did he? The only jhana which he attained prior to his enlightenment was under the rose apple tree. As a young boy. Since that time, he never did jhanas again. To get the jhana, you have to have this middle way, not too ascetic. After he left the home, he was far too ascetic. And when he found out that did not work, he gave that up because he remembered his experience under the rose apple tree and said that perhaps that could be the way to enlightenment, to Bodhi. and the insight arose, that is the way to Bodhi. But I cannot attain those jhanas with the lifestyle I've got now. And so he left that ascetic lifestyle. His five friends, as soon as he saw leaving that ascetic lifestyle, saying, this guy has left the practice, he's not trying any hard anymore, he's slacking off, he'll never get enlightened. And that's why they abandoned him. For the Buddha-to-be realized that that is a path which leads to jhanas. It's the same way that some people come to this retreat. That's your Brahma's retreat. You can sleep as much as you like, you get up whenever you like. How can you ever get anywhere in this retreat? If you really want to get jhanas, you've got to really get up early in the morning. 2 hour meditation, and Ajahn Brahm going around with a stick. That if you start nodding, you get hit. That's the best way. That's not the way. That's too ascetic, too hard. The reason why I have these retreats in this way, because this is the middle way. Being kind to your body, gentle to the body, and letting it go. That's why I teach like this on purpose. So, the Buddha did not attain a jhana, except for that first jhana under the rose apple tree. For that time, still sitting on the Bodhi tree, no. Hindu gurus who meditate and attain various stages of jhanas. It's before the Buddha's time, no. There is no record in any scripture before the time of the Buddha where there was jhanas. And I said this today to someone in the interview time. There is a very indicative story to show this. It's in the Citta Sanyutta, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, where Citta the householder was one of the great disciples of the Buddha. He was an anagami, a non-returner. And he knew the jhanas, he could attain them very easily. He was a great lay disciple. And one day he went to see the leader of the Jains, Mahavira, who was a contemporary of the Buddha. And what most scholars say, that probably at that time the Jains had more followers than the Buddhists. And he went there to have a chat with the leader of the Jains, and the Jains recognized him as one of the Buddha's disciples and started talking to him. He said, do you believe all this rumor about you can meditate and stop thinking? And Citta replied, no, I don't believe that. And Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, applauded and said, see, even a disciple of the Samana Gotama, which was his name for the Buddha, wouldn't call him a Buddha, called him Gotama. The recluse Gotama, even his disciples don't believe that rubbish. You can't stop thinking, no more than you can put your fist and stop the river Ganges. It's just ridiculous what the Buddha says, say you can stop thinking. And even his disciple, his well-known disciple, Citta, agrees with me there. And then Citta said, no, I don't believe it, I know it, because I experience it very often. Oh, these disciples of Gotama are devious. It's very hard to have a conversation with them. In other words, you know, as a Buddhist, you don't believe, you know from experience. But more than that, it was actually showing that even the leader of the Jains, perhaps the most famous religious teacher of that time, had no experience of meditation, to the point where he thought that was absolutely impossible, cannot be done. That's very, very, very strong evidence that the Buddha started this meditation tradition, began it, discovered it, and taught it. And afterwards, the Hindu tradition started meditating. But I don't know too much about the Hindu meditation tradition, but I do know from disciple of Swami Muktananda, who was a very, very well respected leader of that tradition at the time. When he was talking about meditation, he was saying a very similar start to meditation, but he was saying that when you get the blue nimitta and you emerge into that, that's called enlightenment in their tradition. That's it, you're a saint after that. And I was very interested to hear that, because you know, the blue nimitta, it doesn't matter what colour it is, that's the same nimitta as you get in this meditation you're doing here. But what he's actually saying, when you merge into that, that's the first jhana. But in that tradition, it seemed to me, from what I heard from that disciple, that the first jhana to them was full enlightenment. But obviously, as in our tradition, the first jhana has got many, many levels beyond that.
And it's not enlightenment, but it's damn close. Well, that's the only thing I know about Hinduism and the modern ideas of meditation and how the jhanas of our tradition and the samadhi of their tradition match together. Any comments on that? Okay, I might be wrong there because I don't know really too much what I'm speaking about. Hasn't stopped me before, won't stop me now. Philosophically speaking. Okay, so my question is, where does Hinduism stop in a sense? What extra or more has Buddha achieved? Is it the very difficult concept of anatta? Was enlightenment this realization of anatta, since Hindus too believe in dukkha and craving, etc.? It's anatta, dukkha, seeing the fullness of dukkha. Everything is dukkha, even that state of samadhi is dukkha, so you can't even stop there, you have to let go of everything. But there is no knower. One of the differences between Buddhism and Hinduism is that still they look at like a paramatma, like an ultimate knowing, the ground of all being, the ultimate. And Buddhism say, no, even that is impermanent, subject to cessation. The point being here is that you can't get to these truths by just reasoning. When you get into these jhanas, it just blows your perceptions apart, and you see that things which shouldn't disappear do disappear. You see, first of all, like will, choice disappearing. And then you start to see knowing disappearing, fragmenting and just falling away. What you're doing there is seeing the last places where you think a self can exist in the knower or the doer. In consciousness, you can see that is ceasing. It stops. It nibbanas. And that's a powerful realization which you cannot think about. You have to see. It makes no sense. Usually it just makes people afraid. I don't want to disappear. I want to become enlightened and enjoy it. Rather than just disappearing forever and ever and ever. But I'll say more about that in a later talk on anatta and enlightenment. When sloth and torpor start to engulf present moment awareness, what then? Go to bed. When sloth and torpor start to engulf present moment awareness, what then? Okay, because, you know, just allow it to disappear. However, you should have remembered that one of the first talks I said is when you have sloth and torpor, just allow it to be. It doesn't engulf present moment awareness. Present moment awareness embraces sloth and torpor. You're just aware of being a bit dull and sleepy. The point is, when we're aware of dullness and sleepiness, we think that that's wrong, that's bad, we should do something about it. Or we get embarrassed. We think that someone might be watching me and seeing I'm not the great meditator I'm supposed to be. I'm sleepy, I'm snoring. The point is that there's nothing wrong with sloth and torpor. It's nature. It's not that you've stuffed up and done something wrong, it's just because you're tired. So, let it be kind to sloth and torpor. Say, sloth and torpor, the door of my heart is open to you. Come in, take me, sloth and torpor. If you have that attitude, because you're making peace, you're being kind to sloth and torpor, it does not last that long. You're undermining its causes, which is stress, struggle, striving, which depletes you of energy, so you have got sloth and torpor. If you have sloth and torpor, it's old karma, it's a result of what you've done in the past. So you just got to endure it, take it. Nothing wrong with it. But don't make bad karma now. Don't fight and have negativity and ill will towards sloth and torpor. If you have ill will towards sloth and torpor, you get negative, you struggle, and you are causing more sloth and torpor for the future. So you make peace, you have kindness, metta towards sloth and torpor, and because of that you're making this beautiful karma, you're giving energy, pure energy to the mind. And that pure energy is what overcomes sloth and torpor. So in the present moment awareness, just allow sloth and torpor to be one of the allowable guests in your party. you have an invitation to come in whenever you want, Stossen Torpa. So come in and I'll be your friend. Don't think of it as an enemy. Of all of the hindrances, sloth and torpor is the least one you have to worry about. That story I haven't said yet, but it's one of my favourite stories. It's in one of the commentaries. The Buddha was walking with Ananda, his faithful disciple, when they went into a forest, and there they saw a monk sitting meditation. His back was perfectly straight. His head was well balanced. His hands were in the proper posture, which is the right hand over the left hand with the thumb slightly touching. His head wasn't too far forward or too far back. And there he was in the perfect meditation position, still, peaceful, composed, meditating. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, I'm worried about him. And 2 weeks later, that guy had disrobed and got married. The Buddha was right. He went deeper into the jungle and there he saw another monk. His legs were all over the place. One hand was over here, another hand was over there, and he was nodding this way and nodding that way. Nodding all over the place. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about him. 2 weeks later, he was enlightened with all the psychic powers. When I first read that story, I thought, that's strange. That's not what I expected. I thought that to become enlightened, you've got to put energy into your body and have the perfect posture and look like the perfect yogi or meditator. Now that's coming from control and ego. That first monk was so controlling his body and his mind, there's no way he was getting into any enlightenment. The second monk was letting go. He wasn't so concerned with people looking at him. He was relaxing. He was going for that sloth and torpor. After sloth and torpor, you come to peace. And after peace, your mind concentrates and gets deep in meditation. So for all of you who have sloth and torpor, who knows, in 2 weeks you may be fully enlightened with all the stuff. If you're sitting dead straight, I'm worried about you. So you see the point there, it's the control freak, that's the big enemy there. So don't be a control freak, don't worry about what other people think of you. And that way you understand what meditation is. Letting go, being at peace. Just letting nature take you to nirvana. Don't be the driver. That was a great discovery of the Buddha, how to get into jhanas. Not by making it happen, not by struggling and forcing it, but by letting it go and allowing these beautiful jhanas just to flower all by themselves. Okay, so that's the last question this evening. Has anyone got anything else they want to say? Or do you all want to go to bed? Sometimes I ask any questions and somebody I'll put their hand up and say, can we go now? So that's the last question, and the answer is yes, you can go. So, maybe see you the following morning, sometimes maybe not. Whatever happens, have fun. And those of you who've got energy, you can sit longer. Those of you who want to go to bed, you can do flat out meditation. And have a nice evening. See you tomorrow.